number of gaps in the information that we have, and particularly in the very early days. And I would like very much for you to be thinking about that while we're making this presentation. We'll start off this morning. Walter has had an introduction, but there's a few more things I'd like to tell you about him, because there are many new people in the organization. You think that really in the years that we've been in existence that, gee, everybody knows this and that, but there are many, many new people that are becoming members, and for that reason, we probably will be a little more detailed than we would otherwise. Walter is Associate Professor Emeritus of Landscape Architecture, and I think that's a very interesting situation in connection with sound recording. He's curator of the Syracuse University Audio Archives and director of Thomas A. Edison Recording Laboratory. You've heard about this. He's associate member of the American Institute of Architecture, member of the IASA, International Association of Sound Archives. He's member of Syracuse University Library Association, and he's life member of Audio Engineering Society. Founding member of the Association of the Recorded Sound Collections, an honorary member of the Audio Engineering Society, the Order of Caballero from Ambassador Virgil Barco, Colombia, and a special citation, National Academy of Recorded Arts and Sciences in 1977. And there are even more, but we've asked Walter to start the talks this morning, and which I hope will turn into a well-rounded audience participation. Particular. First, we will start by each one of the panelists talking for a few minutes, and then we will be at the microphones to answer, to talk for other things that may be generated from this discussion at the podium. So when you're thinking of questions you might like to ask too, to clarify some of the early material. So with that, Walter, I'd like to turn it over to you to start the
I'm afraid I can't live up to the advanced billing. I'm just going to go back and recount the truly humble beginnings. The Association for Recorded Sound Collections is now Sweet 16. I wish I was back there too. We at Syracuse University's Arthur and Dan Delfer Audio Laboratory and Archives wish to welcome back the members of ours, especially those hardy pioneers who were here at the time of its founding. We regret that our new facilities are quite incomplete, lacking equipment on order and being made. Therefore, we hope you will forgive the lack of a formal demonstration at this time. About all you can see is that we're getting ready to do things, and I apologize because I had no idea that time was running out so fast. As this first event of your 1982 convention is to be devoted primarily to oral history, I will contribute succinctly a few pertinent facts I have to offer as to those almost forgotten early days. First, as a youth, I had become fascinated by the Edison Ambarola, especially its functional efficiency and the simple, unaffected realism of its reproduction of sound. However, I was also aware of the almost unbelievable attainments of Edison in many diverse areas of research and invention. Moreover, I read avidly the publicity about the conflicting claims of dozens of inventors in the fields of telephony, electric lighting, as well as others too numerous to mention. It was difficult for me to believe that one man totally without formal education, could accomplish so much as was claimed for Thomas A. Edison. Therefore, I was quite ready to believe the stories that were being circulated to the effect that Edison stole most of his ideas from others. Because I was a high school dropout, I had my attention diverted for a time. I don't remember, and maybe just as well as for forget, the things perhaps that diverted my attention. But it became interested in commercial displays and lighting. It was in this activity that I met Noble Clark, inventor of the Clark Irish Harp, whose uncle of the same name was the founder of the Noble Clark Piano Company, which I believe was located in Chicago. Noble Clark of Syracuse succeeded his father, George, in operating a music store. Noble incorporated the business as the Clark Music Company and greatly expanded it, and he became nationally known for his accomplishments in merchandising. Purchasing a building centrally located, he rented most of the space for studios, for music teachers, local organizations for booking seasonal musical programs and related activities. It was in the course of this development that he learned of my work as a displayman and employed my services for windows, displays, and to supervise interior showroom arrangements as well. We became good friends. And as he was a leading dealer in phonographs and records, I soon found out much about the bitter competition in that business. Also, I found that despite the fact that the Clark Music Company really had to have the Victor franchise, because of the fact that most of the great musicians who lived in Syracuse on tour were Victor artists, so otherwise all the records were sold as a result of local performances would have been sold by other downtown competitors. Despite the fact that the local music civic leaders sold their tickets individually or by season subscriptions from offices in the Clark building. So it becomes very complicated as to where Edison fitted in all this. However, I feel that Clark was quite aware that Edison discs, phonographs, and records were technically superior, but that his associates felt he was not really well advised to carry the line, so he reluctantly dropped it now and then, even though his father had been the original Syracuse Edison cylinder phonograph dealer. So in the first phonograph that was available to the public here in this store. About that time I met Richard Wright, president of the Onondaga Historical Association, who had acquired a scrapbook which had been once the property of Edward D. Easton, at one time a U.S. Supreme Court reporter who became one of the organizers of the Columbia Phonograph Company in Washington, D.C., which as the name implies, was organized to operate as the local company under Edison patents licensed by the North American Phonograph Company to sell the forthcoming new Edison digital phonograph. The problem is that Edward Easton with his associates, principal lawyers and reporters also have made arrangements to sell a competing new instrument called the graphophone, also designed to perform the same services for dictating and transcribing information useful in court cases. This is what got me started off on my great search to find out what the truth was, and I will say, despite all of the minor errors of fact and pinpoint of the stereo, that as far as the law is concerned, the decisions I researched in the Supreme Court library in the courthouse here at Syracuse, New York Public Library, with the assistance of Phil Miller, who was the first to performing material that led me to other sources of information, but in New York and elsewhere. That's the background as far as I'm concerned. And I think it gives an opportunity to know what's happening further.
Well, you fulfilled one of the things that started this morning. Steve Smullyan suggested to Water that he take an old cylinder and throw it out in the crowd to start the ball rolling, like we do at the spring game. Well, I think he did a pretty good job. Home to the actual beginning, but Don Levitt was named chief of the music division of Library of Congress in 78, which is for his present job. Prior to that, he had a number of assignments. He had a musical background, American University, and Indiana University. For a number of years, he was music critic for the Washington Evening and Sunday Star, presently the Washington Star.
Not even that anymore.
Yeah, he is deceased.
Alas.
Not even the new...
the Times.
The one about the Times. Look at it.
We'll see how it ever moves.
Now the wind is to take care of that, huh? Okay. He's written a number of articles for many magazines like The American Scholar and our own Association of Recorded Sound Collections Journal, Ethnomusicology, Library Trends, Notes, Phonographic Bulletin, Quarterly, and the Library of Congress. And he's working on a chapter from folklore, folk music, and folk art. A very broad-ranging individual. And now, Don, would you please?
Do I need to go up there?
Yes, they left us to it for this. After, for the panel part, I wish to make a suggestion to you.
Well, of course, with the best of intentions, I figured before I got to Syracuse, I would run back to the recorded sound section where I used to work and go through the files to jog my memory a little bit. Little did I know that my erstwhile colleague, Mr. Gibson, had already started moving the files across Independence Avenue to the James Madison Memorial Building. Thank God Sam Wilowski saved the day. He had salvaged a few files pertinent to early Arsk history, unbeknownst to Jerry. And I did manage to pull out a few choice items, which did manage to jog my memory a little. Although it's curious, been totally serendipitous. I find a great deal of information on our Ur meeting, our pre-Arsk meeting in Dearborn, before we officially existed, when we met in Syracuse. I found very little on Syracuse. Steve Smolian has more on that. So between us, I hope that we can put something together, which brings to mind some thoughts I had when I looked at Mr. Heckendorn's title for this session. This is supposed to be an oral history session. And that took me back, not to Syracuse, not to Dearborn, but to New York, the 1969 meeting, which is the first time in my recollection that Arsk came to grips with the phenomenon of oral history. I don't know how many of you remember that 1969 meeting. Our official hotel, according to the letter that I received from Philip L. Miller, president, was the Henry Hudson, corner 57th and Ninth Avenue. Single $8. Double 12. For those with fat pocketbooks who really wanted a posh and also much more convenient location, there was the Empire, where the single started at the exorbitant rate of $12.50. It was in the course of that meeting, which I believe was our third meeting, Harold, check me, the list in chronological order. This was October 16th to 18th, 1969. And there was a session devoted to problems, methods, and purposes in the collecting and archiving of speech recordings, participated in by members of the Speech Association, the Oral History Association, and the American Association for State and Local History. And I recall being in the vanguard of the attack on Professor Starr and Elizabeth Mason from the Columbia University Oral History Office, poo-pooing the terrible things that these people were doing. They were recording interviews and transcribing them and then erasing the tapes, which we media people thought was just the most dreadful thing in the world. We accused them of throwing out the baby and saving the bathwater. I have some guilt feelings upon reflection, and I would like to apologize for my own part in that rather immoderate attack on Professor Starr and Mrs. Mason. Because I think that oral history does not become a usable creature until the materials collected in the form of interviews, taped, transcribed, and otherwise, have been sifted through the mind of an objective historian who is going to weigh the different accounts that he is going to get. And you people here are sort of going to be in the role of the oral historian. You're going to listen to what I have to say and what Steve, Phil, and Paul have to say. Each of us from our own perspective, each of us being one of those blind men trying to describe an elephant from totally different perspectives. Each of us having our own axes to grind, either consciously or subconsciously. So I must say that my concern in 1969 with the medium has been greatly tempered by my concern for the message that an objective reporter is going to have to put together from these fragmentary, sometimes conflicting accounts of what happened. This has been a fascinating exercise for me. I think it's the first time that I have been involved in history that I can recall. I remember when Carol Bradley from up the Thruway in Buffalo started her History of the Music Library Association, which also involved a good deal of oral history. She came to interview some of my senior colleagues at the Library of Congress, Harold Spivak, Ed Waters, Bill Lichtenweiner, as well as a number of people active at MLA back in the early 30s. But of course, he didn't talk to me because I hadn't been around long enough. So I feel particularly impressed to be involved for the first time, to the best of my knowledge, in some small degree in what may be the beginnings of an oral history project. I am in the middle of reading Merrill Miller's biography of LBJ, which is based on a large collection of oral history interviews with Johnson and with his family and colleagues and friends and enemies. And I've also been had several conversations recently with Vivian Perlis, who I think is the champion oral historian in my field, music, who has done some remarkable work, beginning with Charles Ives and continuing with a number of still living American composers of great import. And I think that before very much more time goes by, that I would like to recommend to the Association for Recorded Sound Collections that you look to your own Vivian Perlis or Carol Bradley and start on an oral history of this association as seen through the eyes of all of the people involved in the organization's history, but as weighed and sifted and balanced by this objective researcher who preferably, probably like Carol, who Carol Bradley with MLA is, I think, even younger than I am, and therefore was not so close to the early days of MLA that she could not be more objective than any of the people that she interviewed. I would urge the association to pursue this in a very concentrated way, and perhaps this free form might give some ideas to kick off such a project. The remainder of my time I would like to devote to the pre-Syracuse Arsc, before it was Arsc. I received a phone call from Kurtz Myers, who is one of several people who I very much regret is not with us today. Kurtz was my reason for going to Dearborn in July of 1965. Kurtz and I had worked together on Notes, the journal of the Music Library Association. I'm sure all of you know that Kurtz has been the very indulgent father of the Index of Record Reviews and Notes for many years. Richard Hill, the editor of Notes, worked very closely with Kurtz, filling out a lot of his entries, looking up a lot of reviews, looking up the actual records to make sure that what the reviews said were on the records were really on the records, and sometimes playing the records to make sure that what the label said were on the records were really on the records. And that particular part of Kurtz's operation, Dick conferred on me, which was a wonderful experience, not only in learning something about discography and music bibliography, but learning to work with two of the most remarkable men I've ever known, Richard Hill and Kurtz Myers. By 65, I was head of the then new Recorded Sound section in the Library of Congress. Although Recorded Sound in the Library of Congress, as you undoubtedly know, goes back to 1924 and earlier, really. But the section as an administrative entity was then new. So Kurtz thought that I might be interested in coming out to a meeting of the Music Library Association in Detroit. In those days, I was one of the people who had to stay home and mind the store while everybody else went to meetings of the Music Library Association. So I was not able to go to MLA, but they had a rump session in Dearborn after MLA broke up. And I was able to get out just for that. And I was very glad that I did, because there I met a number of people for the first time. One of them just to my left. Another of them all the way to my left. Paul Jackson, I don't think I had met before then. I know I hadn't met Walter Welch before then. I had heard from Paul, and maybe he can help fill this in. I believe that in connection with his master's thesis, Paul was sending questionnaires around collecting information about recording collections. I tried to find something in my Paul Jackson file and didn't, but maybe he can fill in that gap. I know that I had had contact through correspondence with Paul before I went to Dearborn, but it was then that I met him for the first time. Kurtz knew Paul, and I think it was through Kurtz's interest in Paul's master's project, which was relating to the bringing together of diverse information about recorded sound collections, that this rump session of the MLA was convened at the Henry Ford Museum in Greenfield Village. I read through last night the detailed minutes of that meeting, and fortunately enough, Frank Davis at Dearborn sent me, as I'm sure he sent to all of us, a summary of what those minutes said. And I thought that was rather interesting because we did touch on most of what ARSC has been doing for the past 16, even 17 years. Here's the summary. One, this will be a national organization, its name to be determined later. Two, the organization will be independent of the Music Library Association, with possible further affiliation with FIP, whatever happened to FIP. The Fédération Internationale des Phonothèques died before it got started, and in some degree, perhaps, its aims on an international scale have been realized by the International Association of Sound Archives, which wasn't founded until 1969, 4 years after this Dearborn meeting. But at least we considered the possibility of future affiliation with FIP, if FIP had a future, which it didn't. And the Phonograph Recordings Committee of the International Association of Music Libraries. Three, its purpose will be to collect and disseminate information useful to collectors and those interested in archival sound recordings. Four, archival sound recordings will include both musical and non-musical, commercial and non-commercial recordings. Five, projects of the organization will include a directory of archival collections, which appeared early on, as I'm sure you will recall. Other publications, such as a union catalog, might follow. Near the conclusion of the meeting, the following actions were agreed upon. Temporary officers will be Philip L. Miller, President, Paul Jackson, Corresponding Secretary, Violet Jackson, Recording Secretary. Temporary headquarters will be the Library Museum Performing Arts at Lincoln Center. A questionnaire will be formulated and distributed for the purpose of gathering information to be used in a directory of collections. The President will establish a committee to determine the agenda for the next meeting. The next meeting is scheduled for Saturday, February 26, 1966, at Syracuse University. So that perhaps is an introduction to what will follow. I will only say that along with that file of the minutes and summaries that Frank Davis sent me, there are some photographs. And what is nostalgia time without photographs? I don't want to pass these around. I'm afraid of getting a lot of thumbprints on these glossies. But how about, Harold, if I put them down on the front of the stage, spread them out, so after the session you might come up and have a look at them without getting too many thumbprints on them. I think you'll see some familiar faces there. All of us have aged an awful lot. But you might recognize it still. But there, accompanying the pictures, there is a page that Frank sent me with identifications, in case you have too much trouble recognizing us with and without beards and so forth. Thank you very much. That's all I'd better say for now.
Thanks very much, Don. That's very, very interesting. With that background, I would now want to introduce the man who Don's already told you was really responsible for the actual initiation of ARCS. Paul Jackson is a publisher, bibliographer, and an author for Recorded Sound Search. He's been responsible for much of the organizational development, not only of ARCS, but of also Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives, Motown Records, TRO Music Publishers Corporate Record Program, Oakland University Performing Arts Library, and the reorganization of the United Way of Illinois. He's also a senior marketing representative for the Radio Shack Computer Center, which handles most of downstate Illinois. Paul, we can say a lot more here, but I turn it over to you now.
The first question probably is, it's been alluded to back in Dearborn, how could it all happen in the Midwest by a student of the University of Michigan? I'm going to run through some notes here, because there are a great many people involved, not just myself, and I do want to pay some tribute to them. First of all, I had a very good model in organizational development in my father, who organized several churches. I was a leader in high school, became senior class president. In college, I became the president of the Phi Mu Alpha Fraternity chapter. After the war, this was during the Berlin Wall building, I was working at Detroit Public with Kurtz Myers. At that same time, I was staying with my uncle, Glenn Bridges. Glenn is the author of Pioneers in Brass. He was also a collaborator with Jim Smart's discography of Sousa and Paul Byerly's biography of Sousa. So I was staying with him and became very interested in some of what was going on, along with working with Kurtz on his record reviews and the record division there at Detroit Public. At the same time, I was dating and eventually married one of Kurtz Myers' staff members. She was a professional oboist, but she was also very involved in the Music Library Association and later became the person, well, she was also doing index for the music index and doing proofreading of several manuscripts. She eventually worked with Don Seidler on, the combination of the Dickinson catalog and some other things, I forget the total, but totally involved with association work. Just shortly after I started with Kurtz Myers for about a year, I decided to go to full residency at the University of Michigan. And I was working with at the WUOM radio station and with Hayden Schumacher, who was just starting the jazz program at that time. And I was also studying in a special course for special libraries under Anthony Cruzes, whom I call the capable compiler of codexes. Became very interested in bibliographic research. So the combination of these things brought me into contact with not only who was doing what, but also knowing that there were a great deal of information available, the kinds of things that people asked for at Detroit Public, which up until that time I didn't really know about. I know Kurtz knew quite a bit about it. But so I was interested and brought the idea to Kurtz that we sort of have a group that might meet and pass back and forth information on a regional nature. Many regional libraries, there was a Boyce Library, there was the Detroit Public Library, there was the Indiana University Folklore Archive. There were some archives that, of course, the WUOM Jazz Collection and the Dixon Collection there at the radio station. There were some other private collections, and quite incidentally, by the way, there's a tenor opera collection down in the Peoria area that is, I think, unknown except for a handful of people. But anyway, the kinds of things that we got together. So I called Kurtz and I said, it would be interesting, I'm in this project, it would be interesting to know how. Actually, I asked him a rather simple question. How could we go about bringing these things together? He suggested I call Frank Davis. Frank Davis was then the curator of the Ford Museum in Dearborn in Greenfield Village. He was curator of communications. He, very much like Walter, was an engineer by trade, but handled most of the radio broadcast collection at the Dearborn Museum, and also handled recordings and automated instruments. So I wrote a letter in my spare time at the university, and 3 days later, Frank Davis called me on the phone at work. I was surprised he even knew exactly where to get a hold of me. And he says, to do anything, first of all, we've got to have a meeting. So he invited me out and Kurtz Myers out. First meeting was just myself with two people from, other than Frank, myself, Frank Davis, and two other people. We met at the Dearborn Inn, which is paramount to meeting at world headquarters at Ford Museum, or at Ford, or some such thing. It was truly an experience for a student, I'll tell you. In any case, we met, and I told him my ideas. Now, the reason Frank was so interested in this, and give you some more background, because all these things sort of came together. Frank Davis had been involved for some time. Back in 1957, he had organized the American Record League, which they had expected to become a national organization. It turned out to be more regional in nature, and we saw its demise around 1960, prior to my getting involved in the library field. Also at that time, right around 1961, I remember seeing a letter to Philip Miller, and Don mentioned FEEP, and there was a letter from Europe asking Phil Miller if he would be interested in getting an American division started. And that was back in 61. My work with Frank Davis started late April, early May of 1965. So I told him about these things, and of course Frank Davis knew about his own organization, so he was very interested in getting something going again. So with his secretary's help, we developed a second meeting at the Engineering Society in Detroit, which was fairly close to Detroit Public Library. Kurtz, there's four of us, I believe, Kurtz, myself, Frank Davis, and another, I cannot remember the fellow's name, I think it's on the list of the meetings, I may recognize it, if I could see those notes. But we sat down and we thought about it, and Kurtz said, well, if we ever want a grant, it'll have to be national in scope. And so Frank Davis said, let's make it national. We think of ourselves as national at Ford Museum anyway. I said, fine, let's go. As a student, this sort of overwhelmed me, but it reminds me a little bit, later I'll tell you about this. But at one point, Kurt Myers was sort of overwhelmed also. But anyway, we got together a list, my own list from some of my bibliographic research. Kurt's added some names. We had written two, I think, down for some additional names, and including some people from Europe, I believe. And we initially invited around 28 people for that first meeting, the rump session. We had a third meeting with Kurtz, and we said, well, you know, we've decided when shall we have these meetings that we're inviting all these people for? And we decided, since the Music Library Association was to be in Detroit that year with the ALA, American Library Association, that we would try to design a meeting after the other meetings of the MLA and the Theater Library Association. So that's how it happened. We got the organization going so that the buses, actually the Music Library Association had a tour of the new music division center at University of Michigan. So what happened was that most of the people that were going to be at this rump session of MLA took the bus over to University of Michigan, spent the day there, and then on the way back we stopped halfway through at Dearborn for this other meeting, and we had a sort of cold cuts luncheon at the Clinton Inn, which is one of the buildings in the Greenfield Village. And I remember also at that meeting, they had arranged for some publicity. So one radio station showed up, and the first person they saw, they grabbed, and it was Don Lovett. And they talked to him for about 15 minutes, and the next thing we knew, they were gone. They didn't even stay for the meeting or anything. We wanted to get a tape of that interview, but we didn't even know what radio station it was, so we never picked that up either. And I didn't hear it later on the news either. So those are some of the real beginnings of where we got started, and I think from there I can reminisce about a lot of things, especially, let's go back to Kurtz Myers. One of the things that Kurtz Myers, we were walking down one of the hallways of Detroit Public one evening during the American Library Association. They were dedicating a new wing at Detroit Public, and there was the Dorothy Ashby Trio, and we were on our way to hear her at one of the corners of the library, and I was commenting on who was here, and I said, Don Lovett's here, and Phil Miller's here, and some other people, and Kurtz looked at me, and he says, good grief, what have we done? to a certain, and he said that with a wry smile, of course, and she seemed very gracious about it, but often I remember that comment, good grief, what have we done? And the other thing that I was recalling about 16 years ago when I came here, as I was walking up those stairs and the hill to get to this place, I remember that Walter, 16 years ago, bless his soul, had arranged every time that we went from one place to another, we had 8 limousines parked outside our building to take us where we wanted to go. I don't know if you remember that, but I do.
As you know, Ellen Roach, she called me Sunday night, very, very down in the mouth. You could hear how she felt. She had wanted to come. In fact, what she wanted to do, she said, was to thank Don Levitt. What? When she started, she said she expected to thank Don Levitt for getting her involved in a program of spoken word from the library work that she did, and she gave him credit for getting her involved in it. So I was hoping to hear a little more about that story. So then Don can mention that. Steve Simonian, who again has been in court for a long time and who is one of our members at large and a very active one, incidentally. He operates the Simonian Sound Studios, which specializes in sound restoration. He's been working on building the sound archives of the New York Philharmonic. That is certainly a laudable project, working on the New York Philharmonic, a broadcast and recording history, that's a book. And he, of course, as you know, does a great deal of appraisal work, appraisal of collection. And incidentally, he has, he, he